You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Well, it's great to see all of you here this morning, to see so many family members here. It's wonderful, folks visiting and everybody here for the holiday. I hope you've got great plans for the rest of the day. Before we hear our passage for today, let me just share with you a little bit of background. First off, I want to tell you a little bit about a man named Culver Nelson. Now, nobody's named Culver, really, are they? So he goes by Bill. So Bill Culver Nelson. He's, for years, was the pastor at the Beatitudes Church down here in Phoenix, 7th Avenue and Glendale. He, during his tenure there, grew Beatitudes Church into the largest UCC church in the entire United States. He's got a great reputation. I'm really proud that he's a friend and a mentor to me. He was a fellow of the original Jesus Seminar back in the 80s, and for about 10 years was the editor of their professional journal called The Fourth R. Bill also has nearly 50 years of sermons filed away in the can. Now, that may not mean anything to you, but to pastors, that is gold, especially somebody like Bill Nelson. So been visiting with Bill recently and, buttering him up a little bit. And he has been very happy to tell Jeff Proctor Murphy and me that we can have at it. So we have been going through scanning, mining some of those sermons for good stories and ideas and things like that. So I just wanted to let you know that when it comes to the core of this message today, I wanted to acknowledge Bill Nelson and just let you know, I wanted to admit that I only steal from the best. So our text this morning is an Easter episode that is one of the stories that is unique to Luke. It's not in any of the other gospel stories. It picks up on Easter morning. There are two disciples. They're making their way from Jerusalem back to their home village called Emmaus. We know one of them is named, and that's Cleopas. The other one is not named, and as those of us who've been studying this stuff in Renew and other classes, we know that likely when someone is not named, what can you be almost sure of about them? That they're a woman, that's right. And so it's kind of a left-handed kind of compliment. You don't want to, mention the woman's name. You're being polite. So we really don't know, but we think it might be Cleopas and one of the female disciples making their way back in this story. Now, they are feeling totally wrung out, and they are feeling defeated. The man that they thought was going to lead them on to some new era was crucified, executed by the Romans. And as they walk along, they're joined by this stranger who inquires about why they are so sad, what's going on. And as they explain, the stranger starts to say, well, this is the stuff that needed to happen. You should know that, and started to unpack some of the scripture for them. But as they're typical disciples, especially in Luke, the way Luke portrays the disciples, we know for sure that disciples are lunkheads. They don't get it, and these guys are no exception. They are totally clueless. They have no idea that the stranger that they're walking with is Jesus. And so here they go. They get almost to their home village. It's getting towards nighttime, and they try to get this person to stay with them to have a meal at least. And so our story picks up today when they get to the front door and try to convince this stranger to stay for the night.
Hear the words of wisdom from Luke. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He appeared to be going further, but they constrained him, saying, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened the scriptures to us?" Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, we're thankful for these words of wisdom that come to us from so long ago. May our hearts and our minds be open that we might hear these words anew for our lives this day, so that none of us would leave this place unchanged. We gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. Every year, without fail, we come to this season, particularly Easter. I get there and I feel a little uneasy. And I found this great Bill Nelson story that just really said what I'm feeling like. I don't know if you remember General Omar Bradley. He was a World War II general. You might hear like the Bradley fighting vehicle that we refer to now is named for him and all of that. But back in between World War II and Korea, he was, you know, one of the top guys in leadership in this country. And Bill tells this story about Omar Bradley, who in his memoir talks about traveling on a commercial airline to get between certain meetings. And he was dressed in civilian clothing. He was just ducking from one place to another, and he was eager to get a bit of work done as he went on the plane. Well, as fate would have it, a really extroverted young private from the Army has the seat right next to him, has no idea who it is sitting next to him. So he turns to the general and says, "Well, it looks like we're going to be traveling together for a couple of hours, so I think we ought to get acquainted with one another," which is like the general's worst nightmare. So the young man, you know, doesn't give up and said, "I take it you're a banker. You look like you might be a banker." And chit-chat was the last thing on the general's mind. So just to try to totally give this imposing answer to this young man, the general said, "No, I am Omar Bradley, a 5-star general in the United States Army and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, D.C. Unperturbed, the young man responded, "Wow, sir, that's an important job. I hope you don't blow it." Well, that's a bit like the way I feel preaching on Easter. You know, I hope you don't blow it, because Easter is filled with all sorts of dangerous stories, and it is a minefield of conflicting information and preconceived dogma that it's really dangerous to point out because it might upset people. Like the birth narratives, there are different versions of the events that supposedly happened on the first Easter. Who saw what first? The number of angels at the tomb? What Jesus even looked like? All of them vary from gospel to gospel. And if you count Paul into the mix, there are no less than 5 explicit different accounts of Easter. None of them written by anybody that was an eyewitness, let alone a contemporary. Now, Paul's is the very earliest account that we have, and as far as we can tell, he's basically just repeating a creed that he was taught when he came on board as a Christian. Then you think about that not being written down until 20 years after the fact. The next account comes 20 years after that with Mark. And then Matthew and Luke don't come along until the 80s. And if you want to include John in the mix, that's not even until the 90s or maybe the early hundreds. So we're talking 50, 60, 70 or more years after the fact. Now, Mark and Matthew both say that Jesus will appear to his followers back in Galilee. So you got to get back to Galilee because that's where you're going to see Jesus. But Luke, on the other hand, has another agenda. He needs the disciples to still be in Jerusalem for Pentecost, which is coming up in the second book he writes called Acts. And so in Luke's version, the disciples are told, "Stay put, don't go anywhere. Don't be going off to Galilee because then you're going to miss Jesus," right? So Mark has 3 visitors that comes to the tomb. Matthew has two. John has one. In Mark and Luke and John, a large stone has already been rolled away from the tomb. But in Matthew, that's not dramatic enough. So in Matthew, we have the lightning and the stone actually rolls away right in front of the witnesses there. So what the heck is going on? It's complicated. The idea of Jesus' resurrection is probably the most ballyhooed event in history, and at the same time, one of the least understood. And much of the confusion comes from people not being honest about what is in the text right in front of them. So I'm not going to go into all the details here this morning, but I want to encourage you to take a few minutes. It's just the last couple of chapters of each one of the Gospels. Sit down and read them and look at how different they are. Make notes about who the different characters are in each one of those endings and what they do and how things unfold. Because it's important as you look at these stories to not try and squish them all together, which you can't do, but to in fact tease them apart and see what each one of the gospel writers was trying to say, because each one is trying to say something different and unique and important for their community. And so it's important for us to be integrious. Is that a word? People of integrity when we're reading the text, and to see that each one of these stories is trying to say something important. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Read it just like you would read any other book, and when you get someplace where it goes, that doesn't make any sense, that's okay. Ask the question, because it's probably right at that point where the author is trying to say something that is very important to what they want to get across to you. So see if you can figure out what each one of the gospel writers is up to. In the end, I think whatever they're saying, all of them, each of them, in their own way, is trying to do their level best to illustrate something that can only be described, can be summed up as appealing to us to have a new way of seeing, to see the world in a new way. And each one of them describes that in a different fashion. The whole point, I'm convinced, is not about some whiz-bang supernatural event that happened thousands of years ago that causes us to go, wow, and then just go on our merry way doing whatever it is we do in our lives. It's about inspiring us to a new way of seeing today, of interpreting things today, about a way of making sense of the world today. We can never know what happened exactly on that first Easter. But from their actions, we know that Jesus' followers were given this new way of seeing the world. We're told in the text this morning that the disciples were walking and talking with Jesus himself, and they still didn't recognize him. It was only when they insisted on his coming in and staying with them and breaking bread that they got it. And then he was gone, because once they got it, he left them to be on about what he asked us to do. So the question for us this morning is, what's it going to take for you to claim a new way of seeing the world? What's it going to take? Many of you know that I am not a big fan of Christopher Columbus. If you want to know just how not a fan I am, you can read my HuffPost column from last October that details why I think he is a horrible person and should never have a holiday named for him. One thing that is even more entertaining is reading all of the thousands of responses from people. But suffice it to say, knowing that he is, in essence, a greedy and murderous slave trader that should not have his own holiday. That's another sermon. He did change the world. He changed the world. His biographer, Samuel Eliot Morison, claims that this intrepid navigator didn't just stumble upon a new world. He rescued the old world from one of the darkest moments that we had lived through as a civilization. If you look back in the records to Nuremberg, which actually had a newspaper that was printed in the 1490s, the Nuremberg paper in July of 1492 solemnly predicted that the end of the world was going to be in 1493. So you better start getting your stuff together because it's all coming down around your ears. But even as they were pronouncing this gloomy prediction, Columbus's three tiny ships were making their way wandering into the future. Now, you might say that the world as people knew it did come to an end in 1493, but something completely new was born. And whatever you want to say about Charles Darwin's religious convictions or not, he was profoundly awed by and reverent before the mystery of life. It's one of the things that drove him. And when he was on his voyage in the Beagle, he encountered the Fuegian Indians at the tip of South America. And at that time, he wrote in his journal, "They are hardly more than animals. They are on the lowest rung of the human race." Well, Admiral Sir James Sullivan believed that no human was beyond the embrace of the Christian message of a God who cares for all of us. And so he supported a mission to these people. And many, many years later, Darwin wrote to the admiral and said, "I was wrong and you were right." And he enclosed £5 to be used for the work on that mission. And in so many words, he said, "These primitive people have been taught to see the world in a new way and to see themselves as loved by God, and so have seen one another more nobly." They've seen the world in a new way. Probably nothing has changed my way of seeing the world more than sitting in the emergency room after my mom's heart attack last year at Chandler Regional. Waiting there alone, there was no one else there. My dad was home terribly sick. Laura was still at work. Her parents hadn't got there yet. Everything was going haywire. The only thing that I knew for sure is that the code blue, code blue, code blue kept going off, and I kept seeing medical technicians running around back and forth, not really knowing what they were up to. And all of it can just be such an unnerving situation. And for somebody that likes to get in and try and fix things, there was absolutely nothing that I could do. And while I'm looking back, it's all something of a blur now. But I remember that over those days and weeks, there were glimmers of a profound sense of peace and of gratitude. Moments when life was more vibrant and precious than I can ever remember, especially having been run right up to the edge of death. It's something that left me with a really profound appreciation for how precious and how fragile life is. And it helped me see the world every day in a new way. So it's in this season that we're all invited to see life in a whole new way, as a place where the Spirit is luring us forward through however much pain, as a fit vehicle for soul making. Now, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is known for her book on death and dying. And she wrote, "Learning lessons is a little like reaching maturity. You're not suddenly more happy or wealthy or powerful, but you understand the world around you better and you're at peace with yourself. Learning life's lessons is not about making your life perfect, but about seeing life as it was meant to be." Seeing life as it was meant to be. I got to tell you, too many people see the world as a menace, as something that you have to be afraid of, when it is so much more rich to be seen and experienced as a great mystery, as an adventure to be experienced with one another. Lots of people, way too many in my opinion, spend a lot of time talking about getting to heaven, when it is heaven that we're called to bring to earth here and now. Too many people put things off and say, well, Jesus is going to come again and set everything right, when those with seeing eyes discover that he's already here and he's calling us to see things made right. We cling to our lives selfishly. We want to be safe, don't we? We don't want to be vulnerable. That's the last thing we want to do. I read the news and I get discouraged. I reflect on my own foolishness and I am startled. But rather than give up, Easter challenges me to see even defeat in a whole new way, to embrace the idea that following Jesus is not about being safe. It is, in fact, about risk. It's about being vulnerable. It's about facing all kinds of hardships. And with the Spirit's guidance, coming out on the other side more fully alive than ever. In the years immediately after Jesus' death, as Christianity started to make its way into the world, there was a critic named Celsus who wrote these blistering critiques of the emerging church. This is one of the things that he said about the early church. The root of Christianity is an excessive valuation of the human person. And the even more absurd idea that God takes an interest in humans. Everyone is welcomed among these Christians. Sinners, persons devoid of understanding, children, even cripples. How God will build his kingdom out of such trash, I cannot imagine. You want me to read that again? And when we get to you, you can just raise your hand, right? I mean, sinners, persons devoid of understanding, children, cripples, right? We're all there in one way or another. Celsus saw the world in this way, but Jesus saw it in a different way. And the way Jesus saw it is the way I would hope we as Christians could see it. Because at our best, we've been at the forefront of concern for what happens to the poor, for what happens to the elderly, to children, for people who need advocates to stand up with them for dignity, to proclaim the worth of every single human being, up to and including, maybe even especially in our day and age, our enemies. That is one of the hardest things that I'm finding anybody being able to even fathom as we talk about the situation in the world right now. Maybe, just maybe, Christianity at its best could even include the people here in this room. I wonder if there's someone here this morning who has not seen the world through Easter eyes, but needs to. Someone who may have given up on the world, but shouldn't. Someone who has botched his or her life a bit and wants to get it straight. Someone who is preoccupied with safety to the point that they're not able to get out there and be about serving others. Maybe they're too much given to locked doors instead of open hearts. I wonder if you opened yourself to the possibility that you are loved more than you can ever imagine, and because of this man Jesus, you can see the world with new eyes. That is what the first Christians discovered in those first weeks after Easter. Surprise, hope. In the darkest moments, Jesus is crucified, his followers scattered, their cause betrayed. But something happened that gave them a whole new way of seeing the world. A public execution somehow becomes a sign of hope. What first appears as death becomes new life. And that repeats itself in history over and over again. The Dark Ages end, the Renaissance begins. Old superstitions die. The modern science is born. A monolithic church, power hungry, is finally separated from the state. That is what Easter is all about. A clarion call for us to not give up on the world. On the road to Emmaus in our story today, the risen Christ is saying, yeah, I'll come in, I'll have dinner with you right where you live. I'm going to come right into the midst of you, and there you will experience my presence. And together, we're going to make something of this world. I don't know if you remember the small boy who had memorized Jesus' last words, his purported last words, maybe a bit inaccurate, but I think it's still really good advice for this Easter morning. He insisted that Jesus' last words were, "Glow, I am with you always." So glow, people, glow. Feast your eyes on a new way of seeing the world, not with fear and suspicion, but with grace and the promise of new life. Dr. James Campbell, who's a physician here in town, wrote a book reflecting on how the way we see things, the way we perceive things, each of us individually, affects the world that we live in a very real way. Seems to make perfect common sense, but I love the example that he gives. He says that there are three ways that an umpire can call the pitches in a baseball game. One way is to say, "I call them as they are," right? Now, that's a bit presumptuous, but it's harder to claim that in the day of instant replays. So another way might be to say, "I call them as I see them," right? That's a little more humble, a little more honest. But the third way, I think, is closer to reality. And that's when the umpire says, "They are nothing until I call them." They're nothing. Nothing until I call them. Each of us brings our own way of seeing to everything that we do. And our own creativity is a gift. It's like the missionary who ran into some trouble when he was translating the Bible into the native tongue of the people that he was living with. They had never seen in their entire lives a sheep. They couldn't even imagine what it was. And yet, sheep and shepherds, lambs and ewes are everywhere in the Bible. So he was up against it. He had to figure out some way to fix it. And so what did he do? He turned all of the sheep of the Bible into buffalo. Seems to make sense. And so from that point on, everybody in that tribe understood the meaning of all of the biblical stories we know about buffalo. Look, each one of us sees the world in a different way. Strikes, balls, sheep, or buffalo. They're nothing until you call them. They're nothing. And as followers of Jesus, each one of us is called to see them all with Easter eyes. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.